Sponsorship of today's podcast comes from our friends at D'Addario & Company and their new nickel bronze premium uncoated strings. Whether you are a traditional bluegrass picker or an emerging modern player, D'Addario's new premium uncoated nickel bronze series captures the unique sound of your acoustic guitar. These strings are engineered to bring out the distinctive tonal characteristics of your guitar and allow its true voice to shine through. Expanding D'Addario's industry-leading acoustic string line, nickel bronze feature an innovative combination of nickel-plated phosphor bronze wrapped around a high-carbon NY steel core. The nickel-plated wrap wire provides maximum clarity and resonance as well as harmonically rich overtones for enhanced playability. We had some of these strings at last November's Fretboard Summit, and folks absolutely loved them. We've since gotten some official packets of it. Those were prototype packets back in November. They were awesome. So reveal the unique character of your guitar with Nickel Bronze from D'Addario. For more info and for exclusive online content, visit nickelbronze.daddario.com. Thanks so much to D'Addario for sponsoring the Fretboard Journal podcast. Hey everyone, this is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 110th podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for subscribing to our podcast via iTunes or Stitcher or however you do it. I do want to give a quick plug. If you are into guitar-related podcasts, there are a couple of good ones I want to recommend to you while you wait for your latest Fretboard Journal or Fretboard Journal podcast episode. There's Eric Dawes, the Fret Files podcast, which I can't recommend enough. It is basically Eric Daw fielding questions from people around the world on guitar repair and guitar restoration. It is immensely entertaining as well as informative. Eric works out of Emerald City Guitars here in Seattle and also builds and designs pinup custom guitars. And he is a incredible resource, and it comes out once a month. I just love listening to it. It's like car talk. It's great to hear people posing him questions and to get an unfiltered answer from a luthier. The other podcast that I've been enjoying a lot lately is Steve Dawson, the Canadian musician who now lives in Nashville, has a new podcast called Music Makers and Soul Shakers. And Steve is clearly a kindred spirit of the Fretboard Journal because he's featured many of our favorite artists. He's interviewed Bill Frisell and Joe Henry and Mark Ribot and many others and done a really exceptional job with that. And it's great to hear all these guys go through their influences and a lot more. So check out Music Makers and Soul Shakers if you need more podcasts in your life. So this podcast that you are about to listen to is an interesting one. About 11 years ago, when Michael Simmons and I started the Fretboard Journal, our elevator pitch for what this magazine would be like was it would be filled with the stories you would hear in the back of your favorite guitar store. Whether that was a luthier talking about an interesting instrument or working on one, or a couple of great players swapping guitars and talking about their influences, we wanted to capture all those stories you don't read about in any other guitar magazine. And I'd like to think that we've done an okay job with that so far. This interview that you're about to hear is very much in that spirit. Bill Frisell and Matt Munisteri both happened to be in Seattle a month and a half ago, I guess. And I wanted to have them come into our office and to do a Facebook Live session for us. Facebook Live videos you've probably seen on your news feed are basically off the cuff. You put your phone in front of your face or the face of a couple of your favorite musicians, and you start broadcasting. These guys did an exceptional live session. They played, I think, three tunes. It is available on our Facebook page still. I will say that we also have posted the video from our better cameras with really good audio onto our YouTube page. So maybe you should check that out instead of our Facebook video, which has the crude iPhone video and audio. But anyways, these guys did an amazing session. And afterwards, I asked Matt and Bill if they were up for doing a little interview, a little conversation for a podcast. They covered a ton of ground. Bill talks about Johnny Smith. Matt asked Bill about his time with Vernon Reed. They talk about James Blood Ulmer. Bill has a transcendental moment with Ornette Coleman that he sheepishly tells us about. I don't know that Bill totally knew that we were recording this as a podcast. He does now. I think about 10 minutes into this interview, he's actually asking if we were actually taping, which we were. But it's a great conversation. It is a deep dive into what makes Bill tick and what makes Matt tick. And these two guys are two of my favorite people. So just being a fly on the wall, listening to them talk is a blast for me. I hope it is for you as well. The first voice you're going to hear is, of course, Bill Frisell, our dear friend, talking a little bit about Johnny Smith. And we just kind of started the tape midway through his thought process, but you'll be able to pick it up fairly easily. Thank you so much for tuning in. Fretboard Journal 36, mailing to everybody right now. You'll probably see it in a couple weeks if you are a subscriber, depending on your postal carrier. Can't thank you enough for supporting the magazine and for supporting Fretboard Journal and all of our various projects. Matt will be at the Fretboard Summit in October. If you want to see him in action, he is truly an amazing player and one of my favorite people in this little universe. So hopefully I will see some of you there, and it's going to be fun. Fretboardsummit.com.
To be like a hip guy, you know, and he was this corny old guy around,
right?
And I didn't appreciate him, but I did take these lessons with him, and then so I had this connection with him. And then you mentioned that song Old Folks, and I tried to play that a few times with my friend Joey Barron. This really loves that song, and we played it a long ago. And then there's this recording of Johnny Smith. Over the years, my appreciation of Johnny Smith has just grown immensely. And so this morning, I was like, I had like 7 minutes or something, and I was like, oh, shit, I gotta... So I just wanted to... I was checking him out playing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have time to get it all. Oh, shit, if I would only had like another hour, I could have got the chord.
Was his version a version of the tune that spoke to you, or was it?
Yeah, just super beautiful. And then hearing it now after whatever my little, you know, coming across the tune every once in a while here and there. And then as my appreciation for him grows, and then hearing him playing it now, and after what you said, that you said about the E chord, and then I'm thinking, well, he's playing a B flat chord,
right,
and
yeah.
It's like all these, and I wish I had had time to.
Well, no one plays it the way I just played it, or you know,
yeah,
not that I played that perfectly, but that. Starting with those chords and playing that way. I was surprised.
But you got some of it from that.
From Willard. From the old, very... Yeah, from the...
Source,
early
right?
stuff, from the guy that wrote it, yeah.
And then I was surprised that there were these few things that I heard Johnny Smith do that were in that. And I love that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, that really surprises me, too. Johnny Smith is someone that, you know, whenever I've listened to the records, he's... It's a totally inspiring technique and like evenness and beautiful chord work and stuff, but I haven't found like the tune or something that I really connect to, so I haven't gotten
that was
so deep into him.
For a long time, I'm also, it's very kind of worked out, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I'm actually like the fact that when we did this. What we were doing earlier, we didn't really know what we were going to do, and I like that when that happens, when you don't know what. And he's not one. I think he had things really mapped out.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that always wasn't really what I was attracted to, but hearing him now over after all, there's one man with the blue guitar where it's just him playing. Guitar alone.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard that?
No, I don't know.
That might get, and he plays folk song, like more folk songs, and
I don't know.
It's just this really pure, beautiful, soulful stuff.
I had a personal experience with his music when I was going through a divorce, and it was like, you know, just horrific. And one day I really wanted to hear that song, I'll Be Around. Do you know that Alec Wilder song?
Oh, yeah.
And I went looking for versions of it, and I couldn't find the Sinatra version of it. And I'm thumbing through all this stuff, and finally I find a Johnny Smith record, and I look, and he has that version. I was like, wow, cool. And I put vinyl, and I put on the record, and it was like, I was like, no, that's not what I want to hear, and tore it off. So I think that might have been actually the last time that I listened to him. But, you know, that's a very, very hyper-subjective experience, you know, when someone's tempo doesn't match your heart, you know.
Well, this other, you should check out the one I'm talking about. And that's where that, you know, I play Shenandoah all the time, that song.
Right.
And that kind of came from him.
Oh, interesting.
Him, like, you know, he did. That's all just lifted from his.
Oh, wow.
His stuff.
Cool.
So when I play that song, now that song has all these other associations with Charlie Hayden, or it keeps
mm-hmm. associations for you.
Yeah, just I've been playing it for a while, but it kind of started. Most people knew it from when they sang it in elementary school, or
right.
something, but kind of started with Johnny Smith for me on that one. Are you taping this now? Oh shit! Sorry, no profanity. Good.
Encourage y'all.
Sorry.
It's all being taped. We
don't have to reclip.
No, it's cool. It's totally fine. I don't think I said anything that would be offensive to Johnny Smith fans.
No. That's my,
and I consider myself a fan anyway. So, Bill, I was asking you before telling you about the. When I first was listening to your playing in the early 80s, you know.
Really surprised me that we were probably in the same room a bunch of times. But
no,
we
I
didn't
think
meet
so.
Them.
I mean, I was, you know, I was in high school and then I was in college, and I wasn't living in New York when I was in college, so I'd come home and do stuff. Yes, we were in the same room
I was
at a lot of
at
gigs.
Some of those
yeah.
gigs you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, you were, but you were playing and I was listening.
Well, I was listening at some of those
too. Well, at some point, I remember after some show of yours, I thanked you for the music, and you said, you gestured to your pedal board and was like, it's really all this. And I was like, no, it's not. I don't think so. That was a little later. That was at Visiones when you were playing there with Lovano.
Yeah. I had no idea. Because we didn't meet. I don't think I actually met you in person till. What's the name of that club?
On the Ear Inn.
Yeah. That was incredible.
Yeah, that's a really fun gig. John Kelso does every Sunday.
Like, it's like real. You just. That's felt like I was going. I mean, just like hearing music, like, just right in your face, like that.
It's a nice sounding room too. So you know, people are often talking there and hanging out, but the music itself is so. It's all wooden, you know, and it's a wooden ceiling. And something about the way things bounce off that room, it always sounds really nice.
And I don't think were even anybody using microphones
or
anything?
No, there's no
microphones. It's just like, it's like if you were...
Yeah, I have a little amp. I usually bring a little Princeton, you know, but keep it at a moderate volume. Yeah, I was glad John Rogers brought you down there, right?
Yeah.
And I think I saw you another time in, you know what, actually, I think it might have been after that, in that festival in the north of Paris, when I was there with one of the Bernstein groups. I think that was the festival where I saw you. I think so. Just said a quick hello. But, yeah, no, I, you know, that whole discovery period for me in the 80s in New York... was you were, you know, one of the people that was playing, but it was an incredible time because I had played a lot of bluegrass and played different sorts of stuff, but left the banjo just feeling like it wasn't, I didn't feel connected to it anymore. I would pick it up and play it and I didn't want to hear it anymore, and that's a really bad sign. So I was really kind of lost for a bunch of years, didn't really know what to do. And
where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn.
Oh, in Brooklyn.
So, yeah.
But when you said go into New York, you're talking about going to
going
New York
to the city.
From Brooklyn.
Yeah, sorry, that's a... No, I mean, everyone in my family is like, you talk about going into the city. You know, you go into the city for work. And
yeah.
So, but I remember seeing James Blood, I think, was the first thing I saw that really just totally freaked
that
me
was
out. It made me
freaked
feel like...
me out, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd already been freaked out plenty of times prior, you know, but that was a moment in
yeah.
New York. Totally. That was another one of those mind-altering...
Yeah.
But and maybe... So you're talking about hearing him... Were you in high school?
By the time I heard Blood, I was probably in college. Yeah, I graduated high school in 82. It was probably like 83, 84 or something. And when I was going out to all those Decoding Society gigs, I had already... When I was in high school, I would go see Vernon Reid with Defunct. And
yeah.
That
I went. I used to go to all the... I guess that was my...
At the Ritz or the Pep Lounge and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's wild.
But, I mean, it was such a different town. I saw the Primetime Band at just a loft in Chelsea, and there were maybe like 20 people, you know? And it was just a kind of, like, it wasn't a open to the public thing. It was just you knew it was going to happen. And I forget
yeah.
who told me about it. And I went,
wow.
and I went with my cousin. And I remember there weren't that many people there, but they played a full, you know, like, I mean, a 3-hour show, you know?
Yeah.
And that was probably like 84.
Yeah, I saw that. First time I saw Ornette was soon after I met my wife in Belgium, and we heard about this. Now it's one of the most famous festivals in the North Sea Jazz Festival,
yeah.
but at the time, yeah, there's some festival in Holland and Ornette's playing. And should I tell you this story?
Yeah.
Am I making this totally public? It's one of these, I guess I'll just tell you. I almost hate talking about it, but I'm going to talk about it. You know, Ornette is major, huge, you know, one of the ones for me. And I had just met who was to become my wife, and I'd never seen Ornette, and I knew he was going to be playing, so we drove all night, kind of got lost in the countryside, got there to this big, it's in this huge convention center thing.
Yeah.
And we make it in time, and I go, and he was playing in a big concert hall, and it was Vern Nix was playing, and Shannon Jackson, and Blood, and I think Jamaluddin was playing. It was early 1978,
yeah.
so it was early.
Wow,
prime
Blood
time.
And Burn. Wow.
And unless it was Charles, I'm sorry, I should check to make sure. But and they were, it was in this big place, and he was really far away, and he had like this kind of purple glowing suit, and he was playing violin. And I was like, and I hadn't really heard any of his electric stuff. You know, it was just shocking. But it was, I was just so happy that I got to see, there he is, you know, down there, I got to see him. And so then as the day goes on, I went and saw Oscar Peterson, and then I saw Stefan Grappelli, and walking around, and there's just millions of thousands
yeah.
of people just all over the place. And at one point I went and I got a Coke to drink, and I'm drinking the Coke, and this guy comes right up in my face and said, "Where'd you get that Coke?" And it was Ornette asked me where, and so I thought I couldn't believe that. You know, there's like, and he came right up to me and asked me, and I just said, you know, over there, and he went over there and whatever. So then I went, and then this is where it gets, I shouldn't be saying this in public. This is like some sort of... So then the day goes on, you know, I went and saw some more stuff, you know. can't remember if I saw Anthony Braxton that I went, you know, it's, and I'm getting kind of tired and there's too many people and it's like, man, you know, more hours and we hadn't really slept the night before. And this is in Holland and I swear to God that I wasn't high or anything. I was completely, I wasn't doing drugs or anything, mm-hmm. right? But some more hours go by and I'm getting really tired and there's just too many people, too much commotion. So I found this empty stairwell. There was a door. I opened the door and there's like nothing there. There was just a stairwell. And I thought, I need to just rest for a minute. So I opened the door and I'm just sitting there quietly. And there's a knock on the door. And I'm not kidding you. I opened the door and what's back here? And it was Ornette again and he went away. I'm not kidding you.
No, it sounds about right.
And then, you know, years later, I got to meet him, and I got to play with him a little bit. And, yeah. But I don't know what that was all about. Now it's out there. I hesitated to talk about it too much, because it doesn't even seem real.
Yeah, it always seems to me that I think I'm coming out of a 3-month period where similar things have been going on with me almost constantly. It's really weird. Like I've been having dreams and then wake up and the person calls, like that kind of stuff, like all the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, when, you know, when you're open or whatever, that's how things work. I think that Ornette was definitely one of those people though, right? I mean, I think he was very, very open to things. Did you know there was a composer, Vito Ricci. Did you ever meet him?
No, I don't know.
So I guess I was like 18 or... No, I was probably like 16, 17. And a cousin of mine knew him through some like avant-garde theater stuff. And he was in Soho and, you know, was doing avant-garde stuff. And I was just playing electric guitar, you know, at that point. And trying to get out of banjo land. And I went over to his house and he told me about he took a lesson from Ornette, and first thing Ornette asked him to do was play one of his pieces, and he played this composition that was all like kind of electronic and you know, there's no like tonal center in his stuff. It was very like different sounds and sort of sound collage stuff. And Ornette was like, do you have a score for this? And he said, yeah, I do. And he handed Ornette this piece of visual art that he created that had, you know, various colors and things going on. And Ornette looked at it and was like, and kept on staring at the picture and listening to the music and kind of screwing up his face and being like, I don't know, this is the score for it? Really? And then finally he rotated the score just 90 degrees and held it sideways and, oh, yeah, of course. So I don't know if it's totally true or if I'm telling it right, but that's as I remember it when it was told to me. I wish I brought my copy of Smash and Scatteration for you to sign. How many copies do you think were pressed of that?
I don't know. 500 maybe?
I loved that.
Maybe even more, because back then people actually bought those things.
Yeah.
I remember that was one of the first things that was, it was like a really big deal that it's going to be on a, it's going to be CD. They just had just started making
CDs. Oh, really? I had CDs. It on vinyl.
Yeah. And I think it was some... And we're going to try this and see if...
Mm-hmm. For you guys or anyone listening, this is this record that he did a duo with Vernon Reed back in the day. That was really cool.
Talking about...
what I was starting to say earlier was that when Stephen Bernstein did this record of all this Sly Stone music, he had Bernie Worrell on the disc, which was great, and Vernon played some guitar.
Oh yeah.
And Charlie Burnham was on the record as, you know, a regular member of the Millennial Territory Orchestra. And I realized when we were recording, on the second day of recording, that without any exaggeration, I would say that one person in that room was on my turntable every minute for about 2 years. like had been, because I was going between Blood's Odyssey record
with Charles Burnham.
Yeah. And all kinds of P-Funk was, I was always listening to. And then Vernon, you know, with the Decoding Society, and then the first Living Color record, you know, and Defunct, you know, Soldiers on the Defunct stuff. Like those records were in constant rotation, you know. And when you were talking about being in the same room earlier, like that business being, you know, I was like, my God, I've actually been in a room with all these people's music nonstop, you know. And it was really great.
And
great
then
thrill.
To end up, that's what happens to me too, where you, like, wait a minute, now I'm playing with these people now. You know, that's what happened to me for quite a while that I still can't believe. You know, stuff that changed my life. And then you just plug away, and then...
I never got to see you and Lee Konitz. I wish I'd made some of those shows.
That was... I've gotten to play with him quite a bit.
Yeah. And
we just I guess it was about a year ago, we did a tour in... With this guitar player, Jakob Bro.
Yeah, I love his playing.
It was him and Thomas Morgan, bass player. It was wild going to, went to Iceland and Greenland and the Faroe Islands and way up there. Wow. I've never been to some of those places.
I played a gathering of the Sami tribes, the indigenous peoples of the Laplands.
Wow.
Years ago, with a Western swing band. See, these are the differences between our gigs. This is like, I have a million gig stories that are like, what? Huh? The guy that's the, there's a homicide detective for the south of Sweden and a homicide detective for the north of Sweden. And the guy that's the homicide detective for the north came to New York City, walked into the rodeo bar, this place that used to be
on
Third
Avenue.
Wait a second,
this is real,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, this is all real. And saw this Western swing band that I happened to be playing with that night. And was like, I want you guys to come to Sweden and play for the Gathering of the Sami Tribes. So, I mean, we kind of got paid in, you know, reindeer meat. It was like very low pay, but we got to hang out in February, way hours north of the Arctic Circle. And
wow.
Race reindeer and do all this crazy stuff.
Wow.
And then, like, you know, see the Sami people, and you know, I mean, it was really an incredible experience. But that's the sort of bizarre thing that we get to do as musicians, that, you know, these things, maybe they happen every couple of years, maybe they happen only once, you know. But that was a really fun one.
Take you all over the place.
And I asked him if he, you know, if it was how he's able to take a couple of weeks off from work, you know, being the only homicide detective for the north of Sweden. He was like, oh, there's only one homicide a year in Sweden. And I was like, really? And I said, well, is it a lot of pressure then to solve it? He goes, no. He's always the boyfriend.
Oh, man, I'm laughing. Man,
I was wondering if these guys have any questions.
This one?
Yeah.
It's a Gibson Hummingbird. And my good friend Terry Terrell, who lives in West Seattle, he had two of them. I think he still has the other one.
What year?
It's like, is it 61? It's kind of an earlier one, you know, before they made those adjustable bridges. And it's great. It's super comfortable. Some guitars from this time, from Gibson, the necks, I just love.
Yeah, they're really comfy.
It's almost on the verge of being too thin, but not quite.
I'm on the brink of getting a guitar that is really kind of a crazy thing to do. I'm going to have to get a loan and do all kinds of things to get this thing. But
what is that?
It got a hold of me. Until I got this L5, I was all about like the less popular guitars because, you know, number one, like who could afford the other ones? But I really love deeply. I mean, like I had an L7 that was given to me on my 12th birthday. Yeah. That was belonged to my great uncle. And so I grew up playing that L7, which I thought was a great guitar, and everyone was like, oh, but L5s are better.
Is it an L7 from what time?
It's a 47.
So it's bigger than that.
It's bigger, yeah. And eventually I wound up playing this guitar and really kind of fell in love with it like 15 years ago and got this. But I played a whole bunch of OM28s recently. Like from the era, and there's a 1930 that I'm gonna try to get.
Oh man!
It has issues.
Sounds like you have some issues.
Yeah, I'm gonna have some issues. Let me tell you.
Wow.
So we'll see if I can pull it off. But
OM what?
28. It's the rosewood.
So it's like fancier kind of.
It's not fancy. No, it's just. Really expensive.
Yeah. But it's rosewood?
It's rosewood, yeah. It has like this, it just pops. Like you can lay into it, you can play gentle on it, and it just gives up everything right there, and the bass is ridiculous, and it's just, I just had so much fun. So I'm gonna spend some more time with it. I'm gonna try to spend a couple of days with it and see what I think.
Do you use different guitars would you use that guitar instead of this guitar?
Well, I'm sort of, at this point, I'm kind of like, I mean, I've had tons of guitars, but I'm kind of like a three guitar person now. Like this acoustic 1930 L5 is what I would use for most acoustic music where I have to be heard, you know, just because it's really, you kind of can't beat like sometimes you really have to be heard, and so you need an instrument that's going to put it out, you know. And then if I get to use an amp, if I have a choice between playing this with a mic or using a guitar with an amp, it depends how loud the rest of the band is, you know. But if I use an amp, I use the 150, a Charlie Christian pickup 150. You've seen that guitar. That I really love that guitar. But I don't have a flat top that really, like, I'm in love with, and so that's what this would be if I can pull it off. Wow. And I'm going to have to sell a lot of things, you know.
Wow.
And I'm going to have my first talk with a banker.
Man. Wow. That's so great, though. You got it whittled down. I have some... That's all spread. It's like...
For now, it's whittled down. Oh, man. I shouldn't even say this, but I played a great guitar Tony Marcus had the other day. Have you ever played an Epiphone recording? I've played a couple, but Tony's is like, it's the one that has this weird, severe cutaway right here.
Oh, no.
They're very kind of hyper modern looking, but they're from the 20s, like, you know, like 27, 28.
Oh, yeah, I've never played one. I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I've played a couple, and I thought they were good, but man, this guy... Tony Marcus, a player in San Francisco, has just a great sounding one. Like, wow. Kind of puts it out like this, you know. And we were playing in a jam session with, you know, 10 other guitarists, and I felt like I played his a little bit, and it felt like I didn't need any more, you know.
Oh, wow.
I didn't need any more muscle.
Wow, that's wild looking.
Yeah, they're cool. But yeah, I love this L5, but it also, we were saying earlier, it requires a lot. For me, it feels sometimes like I'm working with a heavy bag all the time with it. And, you know.
I don't know. I thought you could play it quiet, too, and it's something going on.
I think you're right. I think you can, and I probably need to learn how. You know, I think that's probably absolutely true.
I notice how much this one's more dynamic range is much less.
Yeah, the range is much more compressed, yeah.
Yeah. And I probably have it set up pretty, you know, light.
This is lighter than I used to have it. Hey, when did you move out to Seattle? Was it in the...
89.
Oh, I didn't know you were going to New York that long.
I'm there a lot, so
right.
It seems like I'm sort of there. But
I feel like all those years, that you were part of a few different scenes. I don't feel like you were someone that was like attached to just one thing, but you were integral in so much of the music that seemed to me to be like breathing life into the whole downtown scene in the 80s, that I'm surprised you were actually, that you were gone by 89, you know?
I still went back all the time. I came out here with Wayne Horovitz, who was also, you know, he was actually the guy that booked the first week of the Knitting Fact.
Really?
Somewhere I have a little piece of paper that has, I played there the first week that it opened.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because Wayne was found some people to play there, and then that became this whole thing down there.
That was a great scene. It's very, very different, you know. I mean, as you know, it's just the city feels very different.
Yeah. I mean, that's everywhere here. Struggling now, being in Seattle, trying to come to terms. Well, you see around this neighborhood.
Yeah, this building right over here wasn't even there when I was here a year ago, right? Or in the fall.
Yeah, just the construction thing is just out of control.
Yeah. Well, I was in Nashville, for a week in early March or end of February, and it was, it was just
same
staggering.
Thing.
Like, downtown, right adjacent to downtown are whole, like, hills that they've constructed and, like, little lawns and perfect little houses every place and lampposts, and no one's living in any of them. And you can drive, actually, for, like, miles and just see, like, all new places that are empty. That no one's in yet.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable.
But it's more like houses, not big. Like
both.
Here, it's all these condos.
So first you'd pass like, you know, units of houses and little like, you know, an area that was maybe, I don't know, a cornfield or something. And then you pass the big places.
You know,
but they're all just, at least, you know, a couple of months ago sitting there either under construction or just finished. And none of them housing actual human beings yet.
I guess it's just everywhere.
I have to ask you about the power tools thing. How did that come
about?
Well,
actually the same way with the record with Vernon, this guy David Breskin, I don't know if you know him.
Mm-hmm.
He used to, at that time, even when I first met him, he was known sort of as a he was known as a journalist, or he wrote for Rolling Stone, and then there was a magazine called Musician magazine back then. And, but the record with Vernon was his idea. He was, I think he had quite a bit to do with a lot of those Shannon producing the Shannon records, and can't remember how I actually met him. Somehow he knew of me, and I think it started out actually as a, there was some idea, he had some idea to do something with of James Bond theme music with John Scofield and Vernon Reid and me.
Hmm.
I think that was where it, I might get in trouble for, but that somehow that didn't pan out, and then it ended up just Vernon and me doing this thing, but it was produced by David Breskin, and it was also such a weird time because it was right, we had each just gotten these, those Roland guitar synthesizer things
right,
had come out.
That was,
and I had just gotten this featured. this Oberheim drum machine. It was like this time when, wow, you know, this crazy stuff was all coming out. Effects and MIDI and all this stuff. So we were in this, I did a lot of recording in that, what was it called? It was just below Canal Street on West Broadway. There was little studio there. I ended up doing tons of recording in that place back then. And but it was a small, like about half the size of this room, and we just had all that stuff in there and just were, but it was produced by David Breskin. And then I guess it was a couple years later he had this idea to connect me with, and I knew Melvin already, but to connect me with Shannon. And
was Laswell part of that? I can't remember.
No, it was Melvin Gibson.
I know Melvin Gibson was playing, but Laswell didn't do anything.
No, it was just really David Breskin. And so we just met and we did the record. And that we did, that was another, like another, I just miss those places. Like we recorded it at Radio City Music Hall. There was a borderline abandoned. It wasn't abandoned. It was still there. But I forget, up, you know, you'd go in the back of Radio City Music Hall. I can't remember how we got in there. Like you go in the alley or something, then you take an elevator. But it was an old, huge recording studio.
That was maybe part of RCA or something?
I get.
Was that who was based in that big complex around Rockefeller Center?
Well, not, it was, yeah, I mean, but it was, forget what floor, it was way up high somewhere. Boy, somebody should have, but that's where I did a lot of, Zorn did tons of stuff up there at that time. So it was really cheap, but it was still like a real place, you know, just the sound of the, it was one of those big rooms where they used to do orchestra stuff and it still had, the stuff was still functioning, and there'd be stuff, timpani, or there'd be big tubular bells back in the corner with dust on them. Or, wow. There was stuff around, but that's where we recorded the Power Tools thing.
Wow.
And then we, so sort of, you know, my memory is that we were in this, you know, it wasn't like we were all off in booths or something. We were sort of in this big room together, and then, wow, I can't even remember where we all, that we did a, I know we did this one tour of Europe. There's even a, I think there's some bootleg things from that tour. There was a,
I think I saw you and Shannon play at the Knitting Factory.
I can't remember if there was a gig that I couldn't do at the Knitting Factory where my mind, what's the name of the guitar player that played with Pete Cozy?
Oh,
played.
Pete Cozy. I did see Pete Cozy a few times, yeah.
He played, it was said Power Tools, and they had Pete Cozy, and then they had, I don't know if it was Vernon or boy, see, I'm throwing out these, someone else sort of
played.
So they
did other gigs as Power Tools?
Well, maybe, it might have just been that one gig that I couldn't do, but we didn't do many. There was one tour in Europe, and I know we played like at the, it was a London, maybe London Jazz Festival or something, and that was supposed to have become a album, but I think it's around sort of as a bootleg or something, which was kind of cool because we'd been playing more, we were playing that music, but it, you know what happens when you start playing. So.
Well, I mean, because I saw you so many times, and I used to see Shannon any chance I got, you know. I mean, I saw him once with Pete Cozy at least, and I saw, which was a thrill because I only knew Pete Cozy from his playing on Agartha, right?
Right.
Miles record.
That's...
And I saw him with Jeff Lee Johnson a few times too later on. Do you know who that was?
I don't know who that...
He died maybe 2 years ago at this point, maybe 3 years ago. He was a Philly-based player, really, really wonderful guitar player. Electric and just, you know, really had his own concept on the instrument. Ridiculous technique, but like just channeling.
But really Pete Cozy player. Was playing with him?
No, I or saw Pete Cozy with Shannon.
Oh.
Yeah. And but I saw Bern Nix all the time at the Knit. He was like there, seemed like every Wednesday or something, but I used to see him a lot. But when I got the Power Tools record, I remember that the track for me that seemed like you really let it all out was that tune, Howard Beach Memories or Howard Beach Memoirs or whatever he called it. And it just opened up and you seemed to go to the heart of the matter in that.
I just haven't listened to that stuff for, I don't even know if I ever listened to it.
Yeah, I know the feeling. I know, I have records like that too, that you get the CD in the mail and you're like, oh wow, geez, I remember that. I got to put this on, but then you don't get to it. Yeah. Any other questions from you?
You guys are decide to arrange a song. I'm wondering, have there been any tunes that you just absolutely loved that it just didn't work? You tried it a million ways. It didn't feel like you were doing the song justice. Or when you wrap your head around it, are you always able to come up with something that you think is ready for prime time?
Oh, I have tons of things that are just sitting there in the half-finished state, and sometimes it is because, like, I'm trying to put together this stuff for Willard Robeson's second disc, and at the same time, I'm trying to also have two other CDs I want to make, and I'm going through a lot of his music. There's a tune, I guess I'll Go Back Home This Summer. You ever heard that? That's another tune that... I mean, you know, it's like... Honestly, I find like a tune like this, and I think you would probably be the person I want to hear play it. It has all this movement. I just realized I'm doing a different game. Guess I'll go back home this summer. Should have gone there long ago. Anyway, and just something about the lyrics and all the movement. I've learned it, even though I obviously haven't played in a while, but I can't figure out how I can do it that it's going to not seem really treacly or just kind of silly or overly sentimental, you know. I've changed a word here or there to add a little bit of darkness that I think the song needs. Like, the bridge is, after we've talked of everything, then I'll get a restless spell. I'll go by the house where she used to live. I hope she married well. It's sort of like, it's like really a sad kind of story, you know, but, yeah, I find that happens a lot. That's why I think everyone else should do records of Willard Robeson. Do you know about this Van Dyke Parks thing? I know Jason knows about this, but a friend of mine interviewed him a few years ago and then was like, Van Dyke's talking to me about this record he wants to do that's all Willard Robeson music.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, what? And he said, yeah, so, you know, I told him that you'd done a record of that stuff. So then Van Dyke and I were in touch a little bit, and And he said, well, you know, what's the point? Like, you've already done it, kind of like that. And I was like, he's like, more than anyone I can think of, Van Dyke is the guy that should be doing a Willard Robeson record. Yeah. And I told him, you know, I would give him any materials he needs, like anything, just, you know, because I think he should really do it.
I wish someone would. That's if this was like, I don't know what time in, you know, Van Dyke should be like a national threat. Just let him do whatever he wants, whatever comes into his mind.
Yeah,
come on, just let him do it. Yeah. You know, let him do anything he wants to do. Yeah. Take it.
Maybe after this, I'll send him an email and say, like, still waiting. You should really.
Yeah.
Because Van, you know, Willard was a guy that wrote these songs that are all kind of like quirky and didn't really find the right home. They didn't fit into an easily categorized thing marketing-wise. He sang in a kind of like unconventional voice, and he was an arranger and did all these arrangements for a full orchestra. You know, I should play you some of this stuff. Wow. You know, our friend Greg Cohen is, with the program he's been doing in Berlin, wound up doing one of the classes was, all right, you need to learn some of Willard Robeson music, and I think he did Robeson and Henry Mancini.
Oh, wow.
In the same semester. And so I sent him a bunch of the materials, and he's had the students that he was working with in Berlin learning all this Robeson stuff.
Wow, that's great.
Speaking of which, have you visited him in Berlin?
No.
Because the sort of recording studio that you, situation that you're talking about, like an old studio in the back of some place, still exists there. And
like an East German studio or
something? So he, so we went and did a record with the Irregulars, that group that you saw that you're in, and it was Scott Robinson and John Kelso and me and Greg in East Berlin at a studio that Greg was connected with. And it's incredible. Like, it's the old Stasi headquarters for the Stasi radio. Like, all East German propaganda radio was in this giant building. And the building's still sitting there. And a ton of this, I mean, it's block after block after block of giant warehouses. And a ton of the buildings have, or at least 2 years ago when we were there, had windows still missing. And, you know.
Yeah.
But then you go into the main studio rooms, and no one goes in there anymore, but we recorded in this room where they must have symphonies, and the walls had like hanging silk, and you know, it was really great.
That's
to record
awesome.
In a place with, they had mics up in the ceiling, you know, to pick up stuff. And it's the dumbest realization, but it was only recorded in a big room like that I realized that thing that happens on some of my favorite records where suddenly like, you know, someone like Gene Ammons or something opens up the biggest quality of their sound, and it sounds like someone's dialing up the reverb.
Yeah.
That's because, obviously, they're triggering those mics at the top to, like, and I just never realized. I was like, oh, he's reaching a different part of the room.
Yeah.
That's why it sounds that way. You know?
Yeah.
So Scott and John, you know, got into some of their stuff.
Wow.
And you could just hear some of their notes that rub together would then trigger things in the corner of the room. It was really fun.
Wow, that's so cool.
But you should get over there and do it. I love the record that you did with Greg. You should get over there and do it.
We did that in about 5 minutes.
I had another chance for
that.
Was that in Coney Island?
Yeah, it was some, I don't know where, it was somewhere in
he said some
Brooklyn,
studio, someone
way owned, out, yeah. And just in like in a basement.
Oh, I know who owned.
Do you know?
I know who it was. It was the guy who kind of runs the vaults at Sony.
Yeah, well, it was a friend of his.
Okay.
And that one I used, that was, makes me want to get one. It was a Fender, old Fender Champ amp. One of those, just with the volume and, a volume and on off.
That's what Julian's using for all his gigs.
I know, now. And it was, I didn't, because I'm always using reverb or something, at least reverb maybe.
Yeah.
I just had that too
naked without reverb.
Yeah, but I just, that's all I had. Just bam, and a Telecaster, you know, and it was, and we just, we better do this quick because we only got.
And so were you reading most of that stuff?
I think I was.
Because a bunch of them were Greg's originals.
Yeah, probably reading. So he had it together, what he wanted to do, and we just, but it was like really fast. I mean, just in one afternoon or less than an afternoon. But, well, yeah, he's so great. Record.
But it's, I'm trying to remember, I wish I could remember the name of the guy at Sony. I know I thanked him.
Oh, yeah, Mike Panico.
Right, Mike Panico.
Yeah, I got to go down. Have you gone in
there?
I've
never been, but.
Unbelievable.
I can imagine. I was given his info by Vince Giordano, who has a 1920s, 30s like repertoire band that I played in years ago. And when I was doing the Robeson thing, I got in touch with Vince to see if he could help me find out some of the publishing information and like who owns this stuff. So I wanted to do Still Running Around in the Wilderness, that song. And Vince was like, call Mike Panico because he's got all this information. And so I got in touch with him and he was like, no problem, I'll get you the answer. It'll just take me a couple of minutes, you know, let me get right back to you. And then he got back and he sent me actually a scan of the index card from the original recording session, like written in fountain pen, you know?
I know.
And he was like, I have the information for the flip side. And I think the flip side was Tall Timber, which is a tune I know that Van Dyke likes. And he was like, I have all the publishing information for the flip side, but no information for Still Running Around in the Wilderness. Like, and ASCAP didn't have anything. Like, and that's the case with a bunch of this music that you realize, like, things do fall through the cracks. So that was something where I was never able to find it. And, you know, I paid the Harry Fox royalties on the things that I was able to find. And I wrote some of the publishing houses asking, do you guys own the rights to this? And never heard back. So, you know, now someone will sue me. I figured, like, someone can come and see me and I'll pay them what I owe them for the 500 records I sold, you know? I mean, it's like...
Oh, man.
But I've been meaning to make it down to Mike Panico's
You should,
lair.
It's pretty far out. Just those index cards, that's how they kept track of everything. And he knows all that, whatever these codes are, this means... And just has a list of who played on the record.
Right.
But then there's photos. There's like filing cabinets with, like, I looked in this Miles Davis thing, and you see, like, just a, you know, a manila envelope with a bunch of photos that are, you know, I remember this one from Kinda Blue, and then there's another one right next to it, which, you know, one you
haven't
seen.
So this is all stuff
before.
That just gets, because Sony owns those companies now.
I guess.
They get.
And there's some other place, I guess, that's where there's a serious thing that's underground somewhere out. But this is, and just, you know, rows and rows of the albums by there. I think they're in like numerical order from.
Wow.
But goes back. I think there's like. Is there okay? And, you know,
right.
The older stuff.
Well, he was really, he was pissed that he didn't have it. And I gave him a whole list of tunes to look for. You know what? That's what I gave him a list of tunes to look for, and he didn't have a few of them. And he was really pissed. Like, it was.
Wow,
you know,
I wonder.
I mean, you know, just think about all the bookkeeping and all the filing that goes into maintaining records like that. When you suddenly realize that there's a bunch of stuff missing, it's like, damn it, you know.
Man,
yeah, I'll send you Guess I'll Go Back Home this summer. You would play it much, much better than I ever could hope to. It would be beautiful. I think the way to do it is to shelve the lyrics and you do it as an instrumental. It'd be beautiful. I have, you know, when I was first getting into the Robeson stuff, I was playing in Vince's band, and a lot of old timers would come down and listen to his band. A lot of people that, you know, loved old jazz and were at the time in their 70s and 80s, you know, and like, so I've had cassette tapes of stuff just like kind of passed to me. Like, oh, I hear you might enjoy this, you know, in a couple of instances, I don't know who the people were. You know, it's just after a show, like, I brought this for you to check out.
And wow.
I come home, check it out. And one of them has Willard and Joe Venuti at home. And someone, like, put on the tape recorder, and they're playing.
Oh, man.
And there's two instrumentals on there, one of which I have no idea what it is. But it's a great tune. I don't even know what the title is or anything, but I want to put it on volume two. But it just just the melody and Robeson accompanying him.
That's awesome.
Sorry, I can't play it to demonstrate. I haven't learned it. I haven't thought about it for a few years, but it's a tune that I think is gonna, it's a really beautiful one.
What's next for you guys besides lunch?
I don't know. This summer is not super busy for me, you know. I'd say like half of every month I'm different places, you know, than home. And then when I'm home, I'll probably be, God willing, with my wife and kid, you know. Just kind of more of the usual. You?
Well, I'm actually home for the whole summer, which is a...
That's amazing.
And it's been already a couple months I've been home, which is... It was a couple years ago when I gotta just take a... I blocked off a six-month chunk where I'm not getting on an airplane, so...
That's amazing.
But I can't believe how fast it's going by, and I haven't felt like I haven't even landed yet. It's already been like 2 months since I got home, so...
Yeah,
it'll be over before I know it.
Yeah. I was looking forward for months and months to this four-week period that I had just last month when I was like, I'm going to be free and I'm going to be home, and it didn't really happen, and it didn't seem like 4 weeks. If anything, it was like 2 weeks, but it was 2 weeks of kind of frantic, like,
yeah.
I have to recover. I have to recover.
I know.
Then it ended. And
I know exactly.
And the thing is, you know, you exhaust yourself. You exhaust yourself just putting all the effort into fixing yourself.
Yeah,
I'm going to sleep, and I'm going to relax.
No, I know. That's
I'm
going to
fix these aches.
That's what I've been doing mostly.
Yeah.
Putting so much energy into relaxing. I'm just about ready to have some sort of aneurysm or something.